May it please the Court, good morning. Nell Brown from the Federal Defender's Office on behalf of Petitioner Kirk Williams. I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. And I intend to focus on the claim that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the preserved claim or preserved challenge to the expert's testimony. The expert was a physician who had met with the victim in the case and had diagnosed the victim is suffering from sexual abuse based solely on that victim's report, or primarily on that victim's report, in the absence of any physical findings to corroborate that. As the Court is aware, the Oregon Supreme Court decided in the Southard case in 2009 that that type of diagnosis by an expert is inadmissible.
But at the time of the direct appeal, that claim had been rejected uniformly by the intermediate appellate courts, right?
That is correct. The Oregon Court of Appeals had routinely rejected this claim, but
So we have to say that to rule for your client, we'd have to say it was ineffective to fail to raise a claim that had been uniformly rejected
by the intermediate appellate court. However, there were reasons to proceed with the claim, aside from the fact that the Court of Appeals had ruled against it, the main reason being that the Oregon Supreme Court had been very clear that this was an issue that was meritorious, dating back to the Milbrad case, which was more than a decade earlier. The Oregon Supreme Court, in overruling the Oregon Court of Appeals on a very similar issue, that case involved a psychotherapist who had interviewed two victims of abuse about their accusations and concluded that they were not being deceptive. The Oregon Supreme Court, the Oregon Court of Appeals, had affirmed the admission of that testimony, and the Oregon Supreme Court reversed, finding that that expert testimony was inadmissible.
Well, it couldn't have been that clear because the intermediate appellate courts kept rejecting this claim.
Correct. The Oregon Supreme Court said at that time, quote, "We have said it before and we will say it again, but this time with emphasis, we really mean it." And then the language is, "No psychotherapist may render an opinion on whether a witness is credible in any trial conducted in this state. The assessment of credibility is for the trier of fact and not for psychotherapists." And in that case, the Oregon Supreme Court
What was the case?
This is Milbrad, State versus Milbrad, 305 Oregon.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure we were talking about Milbrad.
I was. And that's an Oregon Supreme Court sitting on bonk
Do they ever not sit on bank?
Sorry?
Does the Oregon Supreme Court ever sit not in bank?
The
Oregon Supreme Court sitting in bank.
Some of the other decisions in this area do not reflect that it was on bank. I think that sometimes the justices of the Oregon Supreme Court recuse themselves because they have prior conflicts from their previous lives, usually at the Attorney General's office. The Southard case, which obviously post-dates the trial in this case, is very similar to Milbrad. We have it.
How recent were the Court of Appeals opinions rejecting the claim?
How recent?
Yeah.
One was Traeger, which was 1999. The trial in this case was in 2004. There were several others in the early 2000s. The Sanchez-Cruz case is the other main one.
All predate the Oregon Supreme Court's pronouncement in that case you cited?
They post-date Milbrad. So the Oregon...
Intermediate appellate court looks at Milbrad and says doesn't apply to this situation.
Correct. And, Your Honor, in this case we have not just the history of the Oregon appellate court decisions, but we also have information in the record about what the reasonable criminal defense attorney was doing.
I would say it's incompetent for a lawyer not to raise a claim, even in light of Milbrad, when you've got intermediate appellate courts looking at Milbrad and saying no, rejecting the claim.
Well, the trial attorney in this case thought it was a viable claim. He raised it, preserved it, supported it with evidence, even expert testimony. So he developed the claim.
Didn't tell the appellate lawyer about it.
apparently not, or the appellate lawyer missed the cue. But this is not a claim that attorneys in Oregon did not recognize as viable. As the record reflects, the appellate attorney in this case, who submitted an affidavit in the federal proceeding, has conceded that he overlooked this issue and that it was an issue he had actually argued in the Traeger case, where he lost in the Court of Appeals in 1999.
Right, and he says this was all the talk at the bar and everybody did it. Do we have any other evidence?
We do.
I mean, any reason to think this wasn't just a case of a defense lawyer falling on a sword to help out the client?
Well, we have the affidavit of the appellate attorney in this case, but we also have affidavits from several other attorneys, and that's in the excerpt of record at, starting at page 32, there are several other affidavits. I think it starts with the affidavit of Matthew McHenry, but there are several other attorneys who've explained that the standard of care, the practice in Oregon, was to proceed with this claim. It was viewed as viable. It was something that was expected to be rejected in the Court of Appeals, but then eventually what the affidavits say is, we expected when the Oregon Supreme Court took this up, we would win. And that's why Mr. Simran, who is the appellate attorney in this case, but the other attorneys as well who've submitted affidavits that were attachments to Mr. Simran's affidavit, all proceeded with this claim when they saw it, certainly as an appellate attorney, as a preserved issue, as it was here.
Now, let's play this out in terms of timing. At the time, let's say this, the lawyer had raised this issue on appeal to the
Oregon Court of Appeals.
Oregon Court of Appeals, and let's assume it had gotten denied. When would it have landed in the Oregon Supreme Court?
Probably in about the end of 2007, sorry.
Relative to
a year and a half earlier than the Southard claim. The timing of the two cases coincides.
Okay, but you don't know.
Oh, sorry.
So it would have landed about a year and a half before what?
Before the Southard case was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court.
You see, that wasn't going to be my question. The question is not when it was decided. The question is when they granted review in Southwood.
They granted review on April of 2008, when this case was pending in the post-conviction trial court.
That wasn't going to be my question either. What I'm trying to compare is when the petition for review in Southwood was presented to the Oregon Supreme Court, it might have been Williams's petition. I'm trying to figure out when would Williams's petition have landed relative to when Southwood petition was filed and granted.
Right around the same time. Within months. His case concluded in the Oregon Supreme Court.
Same Supreme Court?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry, I don't mean...
Same judges.
There wasn't a change of personnel, change of personnel, a court, or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I...
This would have been his case concluded on the direct appeal.
I'm trying to play out the scenario had this issue been raised and had the lawyer raised it, had he then lost in the Court of Appeals. Presumably he would have then presented it to the Oregon Supreme Court. He would have gotten there, if I hear you correctly, a few months before Southwood.
Yes, he could have been Southard, the case that we all rely on.
Southwood, and again, this is a question I asked, and you said you think so. It would have been the same justices. Wouldn't the makeup of the court would not have been any different?
As far as I know. Yes, he could have been Southard, and that's our position in terms of...
And it's the same issue.
It's an identical issue, yes, the question of whether the expert can testify to her diagnosis of sexual abuse in the absence of
physical
findings.
Now, you've got another problem, of course, and that is that it was also not raised in the habeas petition. And by that time, in the state habeas petition, right? And by that time, of course, Southwood had been granted.
Correct, which is all the more reason the post-conviction counsel review had been granted in the Southard case at the time post-conviction counsel was writing the petition in this case. So counsel post-conviction counsel should have recognized the Southard issue was viable, and when he reviewed the trial court and appellate record, he should have recognized at that time that the appellate attorney had dropped this well-preserved, well-articulated claim, and that it was about to be decided.
You have to win on both ineffective assistance claims.
Correct.
If ineffective assistance under Strickland and ineffective assistance under Martinez, right?
Under the Martinez, I have to show that it was a substantial claim that post-conviction was ineffective for failing to raise.
Klein did not have good luck with his lawyers. Maybe third time's a charm.
Perhaps.
Okay. We'll hear from the state. From the warden.
May it please the court, Rebecca Otten on behalf of the superintendent, Mark Knuth. I'd like to begin kind of where you left off, which is that this is a procedurally defaulted claim. Petitioner does not dispute that this is a procedurally defaulted claim and argues only that the default should be excused under Martinez, which requires a showing first that the state post-conviction counsel was ineffective under Strickland for failing to raise the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And that requires, of course, looking back to the time of petitioner's state post-conviction proceedings. And at that time, the Oregon Supreme Court had not decided Southard, and it was well settled.
But had granted review on the issue.
That's correct, had granted review. However, when you're looking at what post-conviction...
It's always a hopeful sign. I mean, if you're the lawyer and you've got a post-conviction... I guess they don't call it habeas in Oregon, right? They call it something else.
Post-conviction, right.
Post-conviction. But if you are there on post-conviction and you see this issue in the record preserved in the trial court, not raised on appeal, and you know the Oregon Supreme Court is considering the issue, it would be foolish or worse to not raise it.
Well, I would argue that perhaps in the original trial court proceedings or the original appeal, knowing that review had been allowed, which of course they didn't know then it might be something, you know, to raise the issue. This is perhaps an issue that the Oregon Supreme Court is interested in. However, when you're looking at whether post-conviction counsel was ineffective, you have to look at what post-conviction counsel would have been required to show. And post-conviction counsel was required to show not only that appellate counsel acted unreasonably in failing to raise this claim, that of course, you know, there was no indication at that time that the court was interested in, but also that the petitioner was prejudiced by that in the appeal, and that the appeal would have turned out differently had appellate counsel raised this issue. And at the time of the post-conviction trial, post-conviction counsel could not have shown that because the Oregon Supreme Court...
Why wouldn't the simple expedient have been to argue to the court to simply delay hearing the case until the Oregon Supreme Court ruled on this issue that obviously it thought was important enough to grant review on? I mean, it would have to be a very sort of daring or foolish trial judge to say, I'm not going to hold off, I'm going to anticipate what the Oregon Supreme Court was going to say. I mean, wouldn't this have been sort of perfectly obvious thing to do?
Well, I'm not sure it would have been perfectly obvious because, of course, again, you still have to meet...
It's perfectly obvious to me, so talk me out of it.
Well, you still have to meet the first prong, which is that appellate counsel was ineffective and unreasonable in presenting a 40-page...
That's perfectly fine if you want to talk about that, but you landed on prejudice. You know, that's where you landed. Now you want to shift grounds on me. I was engaging you on the point you were making. If you want to give up on that point, we can go back to talk about the other stuff. But let's stick with prejudice.
All right.
So your argument is you couldn't have had it decided because they didn't know what the Oregon Supreme Court would do. And I said, well, a competent lawyer would have said, hold off, don't decide it, wait. You know, the Supreme Court is granted review. They're going to have to decide it in the next few months, hold off. And the answer to that is?
The answer to that is all reasonable post-conviction lawyers would not have requested a delay for over a year in the post-conviction trial simply to raise this issue, which, again, I think is meritless for other reasons. So you have to say, not only was that an option, but that all reasonable post-conviction counsel would have thought that this issue was so viable that they would have asked.
I can't think of any that would not want to hold off for that. I mean, it's a winning claim.
Well, it's not
if the Oregon Supreme Court rules as it eventually did, then it's a winning claim. Why in God's earth would you not tell the trial court, hold off, don't decide it, wait and see what happens in the Oregon Supreme Court?
Well, we actually know it's not a winning claim in Oregon because after Southard came out, the Court of Appeals has in fact held that failure to raise a Southard claim before the court even allowed review in Southard is not ineffective assistance of counsel. So I think it was reasonable for post-conviction counsel to either to not notice this claim or to decide for tactical reasons to focus on other claims that actually appeared to have merit rather than this claim that would have required a delay of over a year in the post-conviction trial and that also appeared to lack merit.
And so you sort of mumbled the part about, or at least I didn't hear it. What are you relying on? You said after Southwood, the Court of Appeals said, oh, this was not ineffective not to raise it.
Right. So in Umberger versus Cerniak, the Oregon Court of Appeals has held that it is not ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to raise a Southard claim before, under basically the timelines of this case, it would not be ineffective assistance of counsel in the Oregon Court of Appeals. Because the state of the law was such before Southard, before review was allowed in Southard, that the Court of Appeals had routinely denied these claims, had held at least three times in written opinions that diagnosis evidence was admissible, and therefore it was not unreasonable for counsel to not raise this claim.
This all collapses into the first ineffective assistance issue, and that is, was it unreasonable to raise an appeal? If we disagree with that, then the second argument doesn't have any force, because we then, of course, disagree with the Court of Appeals on the
So I guess on
prejudice as well, right?
You have to find not only that the claim is valid, but that all reasonable post-conviction counsel would have raised this claim rather than raising the other claims that post-conviction counsel felt were had merit, and also that post-conviction counsel.
What do you do with the fact that the lawyer here says, "I just overlooked the claim. I thought this kind of claim was meritorious. I've raised it in other cases. I've talked to my friends. They all raised this claim. I just overlooked it. It was not a strategic decision. It was an oversight."
Well, there's a few responses to that. The first, of course.
The best one.
Okay.
Why don't you start out with the best one?
The best one is that says nothing about whether post-conviction counsel engaged in a strategic decision to not raise the ineffective claim. And that, I think, is the first hurdle that petitioner just simply can't overcome. But second, moving to the actual ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, we know under Harrington that the decision of whether counsel performed unreasonably is an objective standard, not based on common practice or best practice, but based on reasonableness. And counsel's admission several years later that he just missed the ball on this is really not dispositive of the issue of whether all reasonable counsel would have raised this claim.
It doesn't have to be dispositive to be helpful. We don't have to give counsel a put, basically, you know, to tell us I was ineffective and we had accepted. But the fact that he explains, look, this was a mistake on my part, that he says this is the kind of claim I've raised, he actually cites a case, right, where he raised it in 1999. So he says this is the kind of thing I usually raise.
Again, that might have been his practice, and that might have even been the best practice, but that doesn't make it unreasonable to not do what he did.
Justify at least remand for determination of what a competent lawyer would do in those circumstances?
Well, first there's the issue of whether post-conviction counsel was inadequate, and I think there's no record the petitioner could make that could overcome that hurdle. But second, it's really a legal issue. We know that the Oregon Court of Appeals had decided this issue three times.
No, it hasn't. Umberger was dealing with a failure of trial counsel to raise the issue. In this case, trial counsel did raise the issue, preserved it, litigated it, so that it was teed up as a perfectly supported, not procedurally defaulted claim by the time it got to PCR counsel. So what is the tactical choice that could have been made not to preserve a well-founded claim? Umberger doesn't address that as far as I recall. Because it was looking at the failure of a trial counsel in the trial. But now you've got that trial court record.
I apologize. What I meant when I said we know that the Court of Appeals has decided this three times was what I was talking about was at the time of petitioner's appeal, the Court of Appeals had decided the diagnosis issue three times and held that this evidence was admissible. But to answer your question, it is different in that it's a claim of appellate counsel versus trial counsel. However, Umberger made clear that this was an issue that was surprising to practitioners in Oregon. This was a new issue. This case really did change the law in Oregon. And
changed the law, but so we're supposed to be bound by the Oregon Court of Appeals factual finding that all counsel, no counsel would have raised this issue, even on appeal, where it had been raised, in fact, by the lawyer in this case, which is contrary to the notion that it was so settled that nobody would raise it, including perhaps the counsel in Southard, who actually did. And
I wouldn't say it was so settled that no one would raise it. Obviously, people raise claims that have been settled, but it was so settled that it was not such that all reasonable counsel would have raised it.
Again, it may be true a trial counsel might not pursue a futile defense, but when it was pursued and then on appeal, not to raise it and preserve it seems, particularly under the circumstances here, seems with or without the declaration, not a tactical move that had any upside at all.
Well, I think the upside is that, you know, as with all appellate claims, focusing on the most merit, the claims with the most merit is, you know, one of the hallmarks of great appellate advocacy. And so what counsel did here was raise four assignments of error in a 40-page brief that he thought had merit. And failing to raise a claim that at that time would have completely lacked merit in the Court of Appeals was not unreasonable. And I see that I'm out of time, so unless the Court has further questions, we respectfully request that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't remember if he has any time for, but would you like to take a minute?
I'll take some time. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Fisher has it just right in terms of the way to distinguish Umberger. It is a failure of trial counsel. Here, this issue was preserved. It wasn't just preserved, but it was, I think, the strongest claim preserved during the trial. So there'd be plenty of reason for post-conviction
counsel.
Certainly
with hindsight, it is.
Certainly with hindsight, but I think so at the time as well. Counsel took great effort to preserve this claim, putting on expert testimony and arguing it, citing all these prior cases from the Oregon Supreme Court, and really developed this claim. So it wasn't a claim you wouldn't notice if you reviewed the record in this case. Appellee also continues to fail to recognize the affidavits that are in the record in this case about what the standard of care in Oregon was. And that standard of care would have applied to the post-conviction bar as well as the criminal defense trial bar. And those attorneys, too, were well aware that Southard or some case like it could have been Williams was going to come down the pike when it was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court. They hoped and expected it would be decided in their favor. They certainly didn't know that, but that's reason for both post-conviction counsel and appellate counsel to proceed with this potentially viable or actually viable, potentially meritorious issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is argued, will stand submitted. We are adjourned.